Last time we discussed philosophy of kashrut. This is not a philosophy class. We're going to be learning halacha here. And the first topic I want to discuss with you is not a particular specific topic about kashrut, but a general principle that underlines all of kashrut. As I explained last time, kashrut is not really one mitzvah. There's really no mitzvah in the Torah called kosher or kashrut. There's a whole set of laws, many different laws, as we spoke about, for many different reasons, and we're going to be learning many of those laws, and each one has its own issues. Okay, but what I'm starting with today is a much more general question, which is, I want to eat something. Okay, there's food on the table in front of me. How do I know if that food is permissible, we'll use the word kosher, or not? So the starting point is, where did this food come from? If I produce the food myself, okay, I grew this in my own garden, I raised this animal and slaughtered it, I took all the ingredients that were here, I produced myself, and then I cook it myself, and everything I did myself, then all I need to know is all the various halachot, right? If I grew these in my own garden, my own garden lived in Eretz Yisrael, then I have to learn the laws of the mitzvah that flew up Eretz to make sure I took truma and maser properly and all the other things with that. I have to make sure I checked it for bugs properly. If I slaughtered the animal, I have to learn hilchos shechita and trefos and nikur and all these type of things. So I have to know all of the laws that relate to these things and then make sure I carry them out properly. If so, then I know it's kosher, right? Okay. So many of those laws, not all of them, obviously, but many of those laws we'll be studying over the course of the year in this class. But that's not what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about, let's assume that the food that's in front of me, either entirely or in part, was not produced by me. Okay, it was produced by someone else. This could be because this food that's in front of me is actually in your house, and I'm a guest in your home, and you're serving me this food. It could be because I'm sitting in some restaurant or food establishment where I've bought this food. Or it could even be that I prepared the food myself, but I didn't produce it. I made the food myself, but from ingredients that I brought in a store. I'm not the farmer who grew these vegetables. I'm not the farmer who raised these animals. I'm not the shochet who slaughtered them, and I'm not the person who prepared them. And whatever other ingredients are contained in there, I'm not the person who did that either. You all know that we have a system today where we have symbols and various forms of supervision. But what I want to discuss right now is the halachic basis for that. How do I know in halacha that if I need in halacha to determine a fact that I don't know, okay? I don't know what the situation is, but I need to decide what the situation is. How do we establish facts in halacha? Can anyone think of a different situation in halacha where I don't know the facts, but I need to make, I need to determine what the facts are, and I'm not, I don't have access to the, I wasn't there, let's say, or whatever. Yeah? Correct. In a Beit Din, okay? In a Beit Din, okay, a Beit Din, this might be a criminal trial, all right? A person's on trial for having committed a crime, for murder, or for Avodah Zarah, or Chilul Shabbat, or anything like that. And a court could even, in theory, execute a person for such a crime. Or this could be a civil case. One person could be suing another. In Gemara class, we're learning Bava Kama. Somebody sues someone else for damages. Somebody suing someone else because they claim you stole my money, or you owed me money. You know, I worked for you and you didn't pay me, or whatever it is. And the other guy says, what are you talking about? Of course I paid you, or you never worked for me, or I never borrowed this, or I didn't steal this, or I didn't damage you, it was your fault, or anything else. How is a Beit Din, so it's his word against his word, they weren't there. How are they supposed to determine what actually happened? And they're going to go ahead and make someone lose money over this, or even put a person to death over this, and they don't have the facts. How do they determine facts in halacha? Correct. We have a principle called Eidut. It's a pasuk, source number one on your sheet there. The end of the pasuk there. Al pi shnei edim, o al pi shlosha edim, yakum davar. Okay, there's a principle in halacha that Eidut establishes facts. If two edim come into a Beit Din and testify that a certain event took place, and the court interrogates those edim correctly, and determines, A, that they are edim ksherim, that they meet the criteria of kosher witnesses in Jewish law, and that, in fact, their testimony stands up to interrogation, and the court accepts their testimony, that is considered in halakha to be a fact. Even though, by the way, we don't really know it's true. If two Edim come in and testify that Reuven killed Shimon, we will eventually, after due process and interrogating those Edim, we will execute Reuven as a murderer. Even though we don't really know for a fact that he did it, the Edim could be lying. And the halacha knows that the Edim could be lying. In fact, there's a concept in halacha of Edim Zomamin. You girls know what Edim Zomamin are? Right? There's a concept where if the witnesses are proven false, then we punish the witnesses. So it's not that the halacha thinks that it's impossible for people to lie. But in halacha, if there's testimony, that is considered to be an established fact, and we would even put a person to death because we accept as fact what those witnesses testify. So, if, for example, I have a piece of meat in front of me, and I'm not the one who slaughtered this animal, I wasn't there when the animal was slaughtered, I have no idea whether this was done through proper shechita or not. If I would have, for example, two witnesses come into a courtroom and testify that they saw the shochet and all the things that are needed to be done, maybe that's not the best example, actually, because shechita, you really need to rely on the shochet. So let's say I have a vegetable that grew in Eretz Yisrael, and we don't know if true manmaser was taken from it, or even better, let's say I have a fruit that came from a tree, and we don't know if this fruit is orla or not, if this is from the third year of the tree or from beyond that. If I would have two witnesses that would come into court and testify, we saw this tree be planted, we know when it was planted, we saw the tree grow, we saw it every day, we saw the fruit be picked and delivered to the store where this guy bought it, then I would have halakhic knowledge that in fact this is a fruit that's not orla or whatever. But that's not usually what happens, is there? If I come to your house for dinner, I don't have two witnesses testifying to me that the food is kosher. At best, I may have only one person. And the same pasuk said, "Lo yakum eid echad ba'ish." So without testimony, how do I know? Is it just that I trust you because you seem to be a nice girl and you're probably telling me the truth? Am I allowed to trust you in halacha? And if so, who do I decide who to trust and who not to trust? Does it matter how religious you look? Does it matter if you seem to be honest? What are the criteria by which we can establish a halakhic reality that says this is permissible when I don't really know where this came from? Yes, Corinne.
So how does the two-dot kashrut work if it's only a paper?
Exactly. We'll get to the two-dot kashrut. This is all, the purpose of today's class is to explain the halakhic basis for a two-dot kashrut. Exactly what I'm getting to. No, so how are we going to prove something? So the answer is that there's a halakhic principle called, somebody wrote all over this board.
That all those terms are actually so helpful, we should have a class on Gemara terms.
Okay. There's a halakhic principle called Eid Echad Ne'eman Be'isurim. That pasuk in source number one on your sheet, which is Lo Yakum Eid Echad Be'ish, if you're putting a person on trial for a crime, or if there's a civil lawsuit between people, in cases like that, you need two Eidim. But when it comes to Isur Vehete, right? You can take that, but that's the wrong sheet for this class. You want this one.
Okay?
There's a principle of Eid Echad Ne'eman B'Yisurim. If the question is not did Reuven kill Shimon or does Reuven owe Shimon 100 shekels, but rather if the question is this meat kosher, was Truma taken from this or something like that, we have a principle of Eid Echad Ne'eman B'Yisurim. One witness is trusted. You don't need two. And not only that, but the rules of who's considered a valid witness are also different. Okay, in a court of law, for example, a karov, a relative, would not be permissible. So if I was on trial for something, my father could not testify for me or against me. He's a relative, he's disqualified. But he's not disqualified from telling me the food is kosher. Women as well. If a For whatever reason, women are not accepted as witnesses in court. They're psulot le'edut. But when it comes to this type of testimony, they are accepted. Okay, so, and where do we know this? We have here, for example, I gave you, there's a number of places in the Gemara, source number two, Gemara Masechet Yevamot, Chaticha, let's say there's a piece of meat, Safek shel chelev, Safek shel shuman, there's a piece of fat. And there are certain parts of the animal, certain parts of the fat in the animal are called chelev, and the fat from those parts of the animal is an iser daraita, a very serious iser, you're not allowed to eat it. And there's other types of fat called shuman from a different part of the animal, which is permissible, assuming the animal was properly shechted, etc. And it's not always possible by looking at the fat to tell which part it is. Is this the chelev or is this the shuman? You need to have people who know what they're doing at the time when the animal is cut open afterwards, and then you need it to be properly tracked after that. So I have a chaticha, I have a piece of meat, safek shel chelev, safek shel shuman, ve'ata eid echad v'amar bari li d'shuman hu mehema. Aramaic, that means one witness even comes and says, I know for a fact that is shuman, which is permissible, and not chelev, which is prohibited. That witness is believed. If he was testifying that Reuven killed Shimon, if he was testifying that Reuven owes Shimon $200, if he was testifying on many other things, we wouldn't believe him. But in these category of Isur Behetar, he's believed. And again, he could be a relative, it could be a woman, that's all fine. But it's still testimony. It works in a similar way as the testimony we talked about earlier. It's just you only need one person, not two, and the rules are different. But it's still testimony. What?
Who's an aide? What's considered an aide?
Oh, so how do you know who's considered a kosher aide? Right? Yeah?
What category of law does
this do apply to? Isurim. Means when the question is this permissible or is this prohibited? Okay? It's not only kashrut, it can be other things also. In a minute you'll see another example. What's the source of this rule? We had a pasuk that told us that when it comes to criminal law and civil law, you need shnei aidim. Where did we get this idea from that Eid Echad Neman Bisurim? There's Machloket Rishonim about that. If you look at source number three, Rashi and not Gemara says a very interesting concept. You know what the source is? Otherwise life would be impossible. That's what Rashi says. He says, V'havadai, again, I don't know how good your Aramaic is, I'll translate, Havadai Pshitalan. It's obvious. Disamchinan Alei. Kol zman shelo nechshad. That's a key line in Rashi. We'll get back to that in a minute. It's obvious that we believe him as long as there's no reason to suspect that he's lying.
Shitalan means...
It's obvious. I don't need a source. Why?
And what does believe mean?
That if someone comes and says, I know for a fact that this is kosher, the kosher fat...
No, I want to just translate the words. I'm saying like...
Pshita means obvious.
Okay, and which one does believe mean?
Samchinalan means we rely on him. Okay? Kol zman shelo nechshad, as long as we don't have reason to suspect him. Why? De'i lav hachi, because if that wouldn't be the case, ein lecha adam ochel mishel chavera, ve'ein lecha adam somecha b'nei beito. Rashi says, if this wouldn't be the din, if we would require two eyewitnesses every time, I could never eat in your house, you could never eat in my house, and it's worse than that. I couldn't even eat in my own house, because I can't trust my wife either. You need two witnesses to testify. No one's going to be able to do anything. We can't live that way. So Rashi seems to be saying we don't need a source. It's just obvious. That's a very interesting statement. Rashi is not the only place Rashi says this. In a few other places in Shas, when it comes to Eid Echad Neman Bisurim, Rashi makes very similar statements. But the Rush, I didn't quote the Rush on the page here, but the Rush is in Masechet Moed Katan. He thinks there is a source. And the Rush quotes the source... It's the Gemara Masechet Ketubot. And it has to do not with kashrut, but with a different law, with the laws of nida. Okay, a woman becomes a nida, she's prohibited to her husband, and that isser applies to both of them. They're prohibited to have relations with one another, and that's an isser for her. That's an isser for her husband as well. Now, she then has to go through a whole procedure to become tahora again. Right? And that procedure includes checking herself to make sure the bleeding has stopped and counting a certain number of days and then going to the mikveh. So let's say she does all that. So she knows when she finishes that whole process that now she's tahora again. She comes out of the mikveh, she knows that now she's permitted to her husband. But how does he know? He didn't physically examine her all this time, and the Torah doesn't require him to be present when she examines herself. How does he know that in fact she's Tahara? The answer is, he believes her. And how do we know he's allowed to believe her? The Gemara says it's from a pasuk. Amar Rav Chinina bar Kahana Amar Shmuel Minayin Lenida Shesoferet Latzma Shenemar V'Safra La Shivat Yamim. The Torah speaks about this, and it says V'Safra La Shivat Yamim. She should count for herself 7 days. It says La Latzma. She counts to herself. Nobody else has to be there watching her count. But obviously, her husband is going to be allowed to trust her. When she tells her husband, okay, this is permissible, he's allowed to believe her. That is learned from this pasuk, says the Gemara in Ketubot. And according to the Rush, that is the source for this principle. In theory, he needs two witnesses to testify that she's Tahora. But the Torah says it's enough for her to do it herself. So that means that the Torah taught us that you can trust a person, Eid Echad Ne'man B'Yisurim. So we now have a halachic principle. That if a person tells me that this food is kasher, even one person, I'm allowed to believe that person. Elisheva asked, what are the rules for who that person is going to be? Well, one rule we're going to see is the person has to be Jewish. A person who's not Jewish is not believed that something is kasher, except in certain specific circumstances. And even then, we're not really believing him. We'll rely on his testimony, but not because we're really believing him. Perhaps when we talk about Chalav Yisrael, for example, when we talk about Rav Moshe Feinstein's heter to drink milk that's not Chalav Yisrael, we'll talk about this, because those who rely on his heter are basically relying on non-Jews to testify that if you buy milk in America with an OU on it, or even without an OU on it, you're trusting the non-Jewish farmer and the non-Jewish Department of Agriculture inspectors that the milk is permissible.
No, milk in America, I'm sure. Is there something that I can have?
According to Rav Moshe Feinstein it is, but according to many other rabbis it's not. That's the machlokas about Chalav Yisrael, which we'll have a class on. Okay? Just 1 second. Okay? But we'll get to that. When we get to that, you'll see that even though we're relying on non-Jews, we're not really trusting their testimony. There's no din of Eid Echad Ne'man B'Yisurim with non-Jews. And we'll see that there are certain Jews you can't trust either. We'll get to that in a minute. Okay? But the starting point is that if I have a Jewish person, male or female, who tells me that this is permissible, that is considered testimony that the food is kasher. And therefore, it would seem, if that's true, that all I need is somebody telling me. So, if Geula invites me over to her house for lunch, I'll trust Geula. If I walk into Rami's falafel joint, you know, somewhere in Rehov Herzl, I don't know if there is something like that, there probably is, I'll trust Rami, you know. And if I walk into a butcher store and the guy says, oh yeah, this is kosher meat, I can trust him. And basically, I should be able to trust everybody. Eid Echad Ne'man B'Yisurim. So then I shouldn't need any Hechsher and Hashgacha and Tudat Kashrut and all the symbols and Mahadrin. I should be able to just trust anybody, any Jew. Okay, so if I'm in Chutz Laretz and I'm getting food from non-Jews, I'll still have a problem. But at least if I'm in a place where, here in Eretz Yisrael, Baruch Hashem, most things are produced by Jews, what's a problem? Any restaurant, if they tell you, listen, the food here is not kosher, fine. But assuming the guy says it's kosher, that should be enough. No? It's a pasuk. According to Rosh, it's a pasuk. It's safra la. A man can trust his wife. From that we learn that you can trust another Jew. The Gemara Yevamo says, Eid Echad comes and says, I'm telling you for a fact, I know this meat is permissible. So why can't I trust Rami in the falafel store that he says, what are you talking? I'm telling you that this is kosher falafel. Why do I need to do that kashrut? Why can't I just trust Rami?
Maybe there's money involved. Well, okay. There needs to be a criteria. And start making things up in the money.
Okay, so the yes, Reba.
Maybe because certain there's widespread, you know, history of people not knowing.
Okay, and we'll see that that's not only now. But yes, Tess. Okay, excellent. So the first point, so let me deal with Tess's point first, and then I'll show you sources that speak about what Reva and a few other people here said as well. Okay, Tess points out that Eid Echad Ne'man B'Yisurim is fine. You can trust a person, but a person's only going to be trustworthy for that which he knows. Okay? So, for example, I'm not a shochet. I never studied the laws of Shechita. I don't know how to properly slaughter an animal. Okay? But if I would take a knife and kill an animal with it, and I would tell you, I'm telling you this animal's kosher because I slaughtered it, you can't believe me because I'm not lying to you, but I don't know what I'm talking about. So a person's ne'emanut is only going to be as valuable as the knowledge that they have about what they're testifying. So for example, if Rami says to me, I'm telling you everything in this falafel is kosher, and I say, fine, Rami, just tell me, the tomatoes, did you take maser from the tomatoes, or did someone take maser from the tomatoes? And he says, what's maser? So it's not that I don't trust Rami, but his statement is now meaningless. Because he just told me that, even though he's telling me he knows it's kosher, he just told me that he hasn't the foggiest idea if it's kosher, because he doesn't even know what maser is. Okay, or, let me give you a different example. If I ask you, you baked a cake. Is the cake kosher? You tell me, of course the cake is kosher. I say, great, I trust you. Please give me the list of ingredients that are in the cake. Okay, and you tell me, well, there was eggs, and there was flour, and there was sugar, and I put in some food coloring also to give the icing a nice flavor, a nice color. I say, okay, where did the food coloring come from? And you say, well, I got it in the supermarket. And how do they make it? You say, I don't know. So you just told me that you have no idea where.
There's an OU in the food coloring.
Okay, but now, what's an OU? And we're not up to that yet, right? Yeah. Let's say you would go more than that. It's okay. I know that the food coloring is okay because I went to the factory where they made the food coloring and I watched them make it. Okay? And I saw what it's made out of these chemicals. And I say to you, where did those chemicals come from? Well, they were from a factory. How are they produced in the factory? I don't know, I'm not a chemist. Then you've just told me that you don't know whether this is kosher. Any kosher supervision organization today has all sorts of professionals working with them, including food chemists. Because you need to know, modern food production is a very sophisticated industrial process, and you won't believe what's in a lot of the stuff you eat. The more you learn about kashrus, the more you learn about the stuff you eat, you might not want to eat as much when you learn where the stuff you eat comes from. Okay, so Tess just gave us one reason why we need some kind of supervision, because it didn't used to be that way. It didn't used to be that way. Okay, if we were sitting around the time of the Gemara and I asked you what's in the cake, you would have told me flour, eggs, probably not even sugar, it would probably have used like some date honey or something like that. And I would say, where did it come from? You say, well, the flour came from Yossi's field, and the eggs came from Moshe's chickens, and the dates came from that tree over there. Okay. But today it doesn't work that way. Today, any product you buy, and again, even if you made it yourself, but you made it from ingredients that you bought, you walk into your kitchen, and the ingredients in any kitchen today were probably produced on several different continents. And many of the ingredients were produced from ingredients that themselves were produced elsewhere. In other words, one bottle of thing or one box of something may have come from four different factories. In other words, the factory that made it got stuff from a different factory elsewhere in the world, and that factory might have started not from raw materials, but from stuff that they bought from somewhere else. And these things are being shipped all over the world. Stuff's coming from China, it's coming from South America, and from Europe, and from here, and from there, and you have to know. So that's one issue. You need supervision today simply because even if I would trust everybody, you need people who have the facts, and the facts are specialized knowledge that most of us don't have. And it involves tracking these things, and involves going into industrial factories and checking their invoices and seeing where the deliveries are coming from and going back and figuring out what's going on in those factories and all sorts of things like that. It's a full-time job for thousands and thousands and thousands of people in order to produce the food that we eat. That's one point, and that's a very important point. But there's another point as well. Even though there is, in fact, a principle of Eid Echad Neman Bisurim, the Gemara also recognizes that not everybody is honest. And people do, unfortunately, lie. I'm going to do this quickly, but the rest of the sources on this page show you examples, both in the Rishonim, and I'll go back. Well, let's start with the Rishonim. There's a Rambam. Rambam, Hilchot Machalot Asurot, Perek Yud Aleph, source number 5, Vizman Shaita Eretz Yisrael Kulali Yisrael, Hayu lokhin hayayin mikol adam Yisrael ve'in choshishim lo, uvechutz la'aretz lo hayu lokhin ela me'adam shehuchzak b'kashrut. Once upon a time, the Jews in Eretz Yisrael were considered trustworthy, But the Jews in Chutz La'aretz weren't. You know how those Jews in Chutz La'aretz are. So the din used to be at one point, and this is based on a Gemara, that in Eretz Yisrael you can buy wine. Wine is one of those things that needs careful supervision to make sure it's produced properly. Goyim don't touch it, etc. We'll get to those halachot. So once upon a time, you could trust Jews in Eretz Yisrael. You could buy wine from any Jew in Eretz Yisrael. But in Chutz La'aretz, you weren't allowed to buy wine except from Adam Shehuchzak Bekashrut, someone that was known to be trustworthy. Uvizman Hazeh, says the Rambam, but nowadays, even the Israelis you can't trust. Uvizman Hazeh Ein Lokhin Yayin Bechol Makom Ela Me Adam Shehuchzak Bekashrut. V'chein HaBasar V'Gvina V'Chatichat Dag She'en Basiman Kemo Shebi'arnu. Today, says the Rambam, the halacha is, again, based on a Gemara, that you're only allowed to buy food, wine, meat, cheese, things that have potential kashrut problems from somebody who is known to be a trustworthy person. But interestingly enough, in other words, it's not just any old person. It has to be someone that I know for a fact is trustworthy. So if I walk into Rami's falafel store and I never met Rami in my life, that's not good enough. Even if Rami seems to be a perfectly, even if he does know what Maaser is, and he looks like a perfectly upstanding religious Jew, I still, according to Rambam, can't trust him until I know for a fact that he's trustworthy, because unfortunately many people today aren't. But interestingly enough, the Rambam continues, but hamitareach etza balabayit b'chol makom u'b'chol zman. But if I'm a guest in someone's house, in any place in the world, the Rambam says it's one thing if I'm buying things from a person. Someone mentioned before money, right? That when there's money involved, that might change the thing, because the person has. I think Abby said it, right, before? Oh, Elisheba said it. Okay, when there's money involved, the person has a motivation. Okay, and unfortunately, there are unscrupulous people out there that are willing to cheat in order to make money. And unfortunately, kashrut is one of those areas where it's sort of ripe for corruption, because, well, let's take, for example, meat. Okay, the difference in price between a kosher piece of meat and a non-kosher piece of meat, the exact same meat, same quality, same everything, can be several hundred percent even. And there's not a human being on earth who's able to tell the difference once you've managed to, you know, change the labeling or whatever. So that is, right, that is a very serious temptation for an unscrupulous person to lie. And there have been stories all over the world about this. There was a case in Muncie a number of years ago that maybe you've heard about, right, where a person was, for many, many, many years, and a person who outwardly appeared to be very, very, very religious was selling completely unkosher meat to a whole bunch of people because he was making a tremendous amount of money doing so, right? So, on the other hand, if you're a guest in someone's home and the person has no, they're not going to make any money by, you know, cheating you, and plus they're eating the food themselves, so the criteria are different. So the Rambam holds that even though in theory, if you're buying it from a person, once upon a time, the Gemara said this was true in Chutz La'aretz, not in Eretz Yisrael. Today he says it's true in Eretz Yisrael too. Because there are a lot of unscrupulous people, you can only trust somebody if he's known to be trustworthy. The Ravid disagrees with him, and he said that's not correct, but only in source number 6 there, Ein amei ha'aretz chashudin l'achlif lo limkor davar ha'asur elem kein nechshad. The Ravid says you can trust a person, unless, you know, according to the Rambam, you need evidence that says that he's, or you need at least a reputation
for a store where throwing out when money's involved.
Not if you're just a guest in his home. Meaning a stam person that I don't know, but I know he's Jewish, but I don't know anything else about him. I can eat in his house, but I can't buy things from him until I have people testifying that he's trustworthy. According to Ravid, it's the opposite. If it's a stam Jew and I don't know anything about him, then I can trust him even to buy things from him, but I cannot. Trust him if I know, have reason to suspect that. So, for example, if a person is known to be someone who doesn't keep halacha, right, if he's a person who drives his car on Shabbat, for example, then I'm not allowed to trust his kashrut because he's chashud. And in source number 7, you have the Shulchan Aruch, which follows the Ravid, but the Ramah, which follows the Rambam. So at least for Ashkenazim, we have that. In source 8 and 9, which I won't read inside because I want to make sure to get through the rest of the material I want to cover today. But in source 8 and 9, you have Mishnayot and Masechet Demai. Masechet Demai was written at a time where there was a whole class of people known as Amei Haaretz, and there were certain halachot, particularly involving Maaser, that those people did not... were known as a general rule, many of them at least.
Number
9? No, so it's 8 and 9. The Amei Haaretz were people who were not very scrupulous with Maaser, and the halacha is that in such a situation, you're not allowed to trust an Am Haaretz, even if there's no indication to the contrary. He has to prove that he's trustworthy before you can trust him. So there are limitations to Eidecha Nemen Misurin. Therefore, in our contemporary reality, both because of what Tess said, which is that certifying food kosher requires specialized knowledge that most of us don't have, plus it requires having people really, literally all over the world checking out where all kinds of things are produced and tracking what shipped to where and what ingredients are being used in what factories and constantly checking with the factories that they didn't change their supplier because they can buy the exact same ingredient from one supplier or a different supplier, but it may be manufactured from very different things, right? The same red food coloring could come from many very different sources, some of which are completely mutter, some of which are isurim d'oraisa, and the factory just has a guy buying these ingredients and looking for the best price, and therefore you have to constantly be tracking where they're getting them from. But for that reason, you need supervision. But also because, unfortunately, our contemporary reality is like that described by the Rambam, like that described by the Mishnayot in Demai, that many Jews, sadly, most of the Jewish people, are not scrupulously observant in halacha, and therefore you can't just assume, if you don't know the person personally, that an average Jew, especially when there's money involved, that an average Jew is kasher. And therefore we need the testimony, and that takes the form of a mashgiach, of someone who's both knowledgeable and trustworthy, who's going to supervise the product, and then provide some sort of certification, which will be the equivalent of an Eidecha Neman Bisurin. I don't necessarily have to speak to the Mashgiach personally, right? If the Mashgiach puts some kind of a symbol, if he hangs a sign in the store, or he puts some kind of symbol on the packaging, and I have the ability to know that that's an authentic symbol from that person, we saw already in the Rambam, right? Dag She'in Basiman, well, that's talking about the Simanim of the dog itself, but later on, there are sources that indicate also that you can put notifications on the product if it's wrapped up with a chotemet, and that's going to serve as, when you see a symbol or a notice or a rabbi's name or a sign hanging in the store that says that this particular person is taking responsibility for this, then that rabbi who's certifying this product becomes the Eidah Chadneman Bisurim, and on that basis we can eat the thing. Yes, Elisheva.
So the Rambam says that you could go to somebody's house and trust them as long as they are a Jew. So what is that?
As long as they are Jew and you don't have reason not to trust them.
Okay.
Right?
So Eli Im Kain,
Rambam says, Eli Im Kain, hu chashud. Right?
Okay. So does that...
Im hu chzak she'eno kasher, if he has a reputation already, or if you have knowledge that he's not a trustworthy person...
Okay, but trustworthy, what about, like, standards?
Okay, we'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
We'll get to that in a second. Abby.
So how is it different than the Ravid?
The Rambam's difference is that the Ravid says that all people can be trusted unless we have reason not to trust them, even to buy things from them.
Can I spell Ravid?
Reish Aleph Bet Dalid, Ra'avad, Rabbi Avram Ben David. Okay, now. So let's say...
all people must have reason not to.
Right. Now. Now, let's say I walk into a certain store where I buy a certain product or I want to buy a certain product, and there's the name or the symbol of a certain rabbi who heads a kashrut organization, right? And this rabbi or this organization says that this product is kosher. How do I know if I can rely on this person or not?
A random person?
Yeah. Somebody. It says kasher b'hashgachat X. Right? How do I know if I can rely on this person, this organization, or not?
You take the paper Rabbi Lerner gave you with all the pictures.
Okay, that's one way. That's one way. But how did Rabbi Lerner make that page, right? And what's behind that, right? So, in order for a certain hechsher to be considered reliable, what does it need? Right? The person, if I'm going to put my name on a product, right? It says, Kasha Bashkacha, Rabbi Haber. How do you know if I am, just 1 second, let me just get through this. How do you know if I am qualified to do that? What characteristics do I need to have in order for my hashgacha to be meaningful? Yes?
You need other people to, who know
you. Okay, first of all, I have to either have myself all the knowledge necessary, what Tess said before, which means, A, I have to have all the halachot, I have to be a Talmid Chacham who knows all the halachot, and I also have to be have access to all the specialized knowledge we need, the chemistry and the business thing, all the things that we need to have. Either I have to be that, either I have to personally have all that knowledge, or I have to have people working with me. It's okay if I'm personally not the chemist, right? If I'm the rabbi and I hire the chemist, right, and I work with the chemist and I explain to him what I need and I ask him, could there, you know, what sort of products, what sort of ingredients could be in here? That's fine, right? And maybe I have a lawyer working with me also, and I have all kinds of other professionals working with me. Okay, but I have to have that. So I have to have knowledge, and I also have to be competent. Meaning I have to have enough people working with me, right? If one person is supervising 5,500 different factories, he probably isn't checking into them very often, right? So I have to have a staff working with me. I have to, my statement, again, Tess's point before, my statement is trustworthy only to the extent that it's reasonable that I know what I'm talking about. So I have to have enough people working with me that have enough knowledge and know what they're doing, that they can properly know what they're doing with. And I also have to be honest. And I also have to be responsible. If I have all those things, then Eid Echad Neman Bisurim means you should trust me. And you should feel perfectly comfortable eating food that I supervise. So why would somebody, if someone says, I don't trust that hashgacha, I don't eat stuff with that symbol on it, why would that be? There are two different reasons, and many people don't understand this, and this is a crucial distinction. Okay? If someone says, I don't eat food from that rabbi, or I don't eat food with that te'udah, I don't eat in restaurants with that te'udah, or I don't eat food with this symbol on it, there are two very different reasons why somebody might make that statement. They are both valid, but they are very, very different. One reason why a person might decide, I don't rely on that hashgacha, is because I have come to the conclusion, either myself or somebody that I trust has told me, that the person behind that hashgacha is not knowledgeable, competent, or honest or reliable. The person puts his name on things, but he really doesn't know much halacha. Or he knows halacha, but he has no idea about all the intricacies of modern food production. And, you know, I've asked him, excuse me, how are you checking into these factories? And he says, well, I go in and I check. And I say to him, do you have any idea where these ingredients come from? And it becomes clear to me that he doesn't really know what he's doing. Or he's trying his best, but he doesn't have sufficient manpower to properly do it. Or he's a crook. He's a criminal. He's dishonest. He's been caught cheating. Any of those reasons or any variation thereof tell me that this person is in the category that the Rambam was talking about as someone who you can't trust. And if that's the case, if someone comes to the conclusion, and unfortunately, girls, there are such things, both in Chutz La'aretz and here. I'll get to details in a minute. But there definitely are people and organizations that are certifying food as kosher that are lacking the most basic criteria of sufficient knowledge and sufficient responsibility, and in some cases even sufficient honesty. And there are people whose kashrut certificate is barely worth the paper it's printed on. If you come to the conclusion that a given hashgacha is in that category, then the person is not a ne'eman, there is no Eid Echad Ne'eman Bisurin, and there may as well be no supervision whatsoever, and you're back to a situation where you have no knowledge that the product is kosher. Okay, if you can hold questions for a few minutes, and then if I still don't get to it, I'll try to leave a few minutes at the end. Okay, so in other words, the criteria laid out by the Rambam and by these Mishnayot and Demai definitely exist today as well, and they exist not only for Rami You know, it's the same way I can't necessarily trust Rami walking into his falafel store, because he may not know what he needs to know, and he also may not be a trustworthy person. Rabbi so-and-so, who hangs up a tudah in Rami's store for a small monthly fee, depending who that is, also might not be a person that I can trust, and therefore the tudah hanging in Rami's falafel store might not be any better than Rami himself, and I might be back where I started from. If I come to that conclusion about a given hashgacha, then there's nothing to talk about, and the hashgacha is completely worthless. But there's a completely different reason why it may also be very valid not to rely on a given hashgacha. And that has to do with what I think Elisheva was driving at a few minutes ago when she spoke about standards. Or let's not use the word standards even. Let's use the word shitot. Okay? In kashrut, like in many, many, many areas of halacha, basically all areas of halacha, there are machloket. There are many, many differences of opinion about various things. I'll mention just a few, and we'll be talking about many of them in this class. Okay, Chalav Yisrael already came up here. Okay, Yocheved said before, well, all the milk in America is okay. And indeed, that was the position of Rav Moshe Feinstein. But there are many others who don't think so. There's a din called Chalav Yisrael, and according to many people, you're not allowed to drink most of the milk in America, only milk that's specifically supervised by a Jew. This is a genuine machloket. And it's a machloket where some rabbis feel one way and some rabbis feel another way. In America, and in many places, most countries in Chutz Laretz, most of the rabbis are lenient on that. That's why most of you, I imagine, drink such milk. You might be surprised to know that here in Eretz Yisrael, not only the so-called Mahadran Ashkachot, but even the Rabbanut, is machmir on that. The Rabbanut will not allow milk to be sold here. That's not Chalav Yisrael. Maybe you didn't know that. But that's the reality. So this is a question of a machloket. Okay, there's something called glat or chalak when it comes to meat. That's a machloket. Some people hold the meat has to be glat or chalak. Other people don't. There's a machloket about gelatin. Gelatin is a substance that's found in many food products that can be produced from the bones of animals. And there are rabbis, this may surprise you, but there are rabbis who hold that even if the gelatin is produced from the bones of non-kosher animals or animals that weren't properly slaughtered, then it's still permissible. And there are products sold in Eretz Yisrael.
Firm rabbis?
Yes. Very, very, very firm rabbis and important achronim who say that. And there are products sold in Eretz Yisrael, less and less because the economics are changing of this. But you know, definitely if you buy a package of marshmallows here in Eretz Yisrael, which doesn't have a kashrut mahadran, if it just has a plain old rabbanut hashgacha, it's possible that it has that type of gelatin in it. And they're not wrong. They're relying on the psak of the Shut Achiezer and Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank and others who held that it was permissible. But this was an example where Moshe Feinstein, for example, was machmir, and many of us don't rely on that. Okay, so these are all examples of areas of machloket. Now, if I want to eat a certain product, and I follow a certain rabbi, okay, so I need to be sure that the product that's certified kosher follows the positions that I'm following. Okay, so for example, if I don't rely on Rav Moshe Feinstein's leniency, okay, and I only drink Chalav Yisrael, okay, and I walk into a store in America and I see a box of donuts that says OUD, okay, so the OU is certifying this kosher and it's telling me that it's Chalavi or it might have milk in it, and I know that the OU relies on Rav Moshe Feinstein, which means that it's very possible that there's milk in this that, according to my rabbi, is asur, then I can't eat that product. Or, if I'm from America, let's say, and I follow Rav Moshe Feinstein, so I'm happy eating the OUD donuts, but I wouldn't want to eat gelatin that's made from the bones of non-kosher animals, and I walk into a store in Yerushalayim and I see a package of marshmallows which have gelatin in them, and it says kasher, bashkachat, rabbanut, whatever, and I know that rabbanut relies on the heter that I don't rely on, then I can't eat that package of marshmallows because it may have an ingredient in there that, according to the position I follow, is not permissible. But that's a very different situation than the first. See, if I won't eat from that hashgacha, because I think the rabbi who's certifying it is not knowledgeable or not reliable or not honest or not competent, then nothing he says is worth anything to me. There's no Eidach Ad Nemen Bisurim here. But if I assume, for example, that the rabbis of the OU are proper, knowledgeable, God-fearing, responsible people who file a legitimate halachic position that's not my position, so yeah, if it says OUD, I can't eat it because I trust every word they're saying. But what they're saying hasn't answered my question. Because they're saying this is permissible according to the shitot that we follow. I go on their website and I read their articles and I see that they follow Rav Moshe Feinstein's hetzer about milk and I don't follow it. So I can't eat that product. But not because I don't trust them. Because what they've said to me hasn't told me what I need to know. Which means if I see a different product that says OU parv, then I can feel perfectly comfortable eating it. Ah, but I don't trust the OU. I do trust the OU. But I can't eat the OUD. Or I pick up the phone and I call the mashgiach or I call their hotline, I speak to someone in their office and they tell me this particular product has Chalav Yisrael in it. Or this particular product has no milk in it. It's marked OUD because of whatever. Then I can feel perfectly comfortable eating it because it wasn't that I didn't trust them. Right? If I'm an Ashkenazi, right, and I walk into a store on Pesach and it says Kasher LePesach v'Hashgacha Tarav Avadya Yosef, and it doesn't tell me if there's kidney oat in it or not, I can't eat it. Not because I don't trust Rav Avadya Yosef, I trust him. But what he's told me hasn't answered my question. If he writes on there, you know, Lelo Chashash kidney oat or something, then I can eat it. But that's a very different situation. And a lot of people miss this point. Okay, they say, oh, I don't rely on that Hashgacha. I'll tell you a story. I'll try to leave 5 minutes at the end, but I need to tell you two more points, okay? You know, let me tell you one point, and then I'll tell you my story, okay? There's a term you'll hear a lot called kasher l'mahadru. That term does not appear in halacha. It doesn't appear in the Shulchan Aruch. It certainly doesn't appear in the Gemara. The concept of mahadru appears in the Gemara in concept of only one mitzvah. Anyone know what mitzvah it is? Ner Chanukah. Ner Chanukah. There's Mahajin, there's even Mahajin, Mina Mahajin, only Ner Chanukah. There's no such concept. There's Hidur Mitzvah, but there's no Limahajin. And there's certainly no concept as Kasher Limahajin. Where in the world did that term come from? What does it mean? Particularly here in Eretz Yisrael, that term has a lot of relevance. And here's why. The Rabbanut in this country, a national organization, the Rabbanut HaRashit is a national organization, and there's local Rabbanuts in each city or municipality. They have set up here in this country something that doesn't exist in Chutz La'aretz, a nationwide kashrut system. You have to understand the scale of what's going on here. Okay, who lives in a really, Brooklyn, okay? Which part of Brooklyn do you live in?
Borough Park. But like Flatbush.
Borough Park, but like Flatbush. Okay. One of the largest and most, you know, densely populated Orthodox communities in the world. Okay. How many kosher restaurants do you think there are in Borough Park and Flatbush?
You can't count.
Take a random guess.
Like 200?
Okay, let's say she's right. Okay? Okay, that's probably more than in any other community that anyone here lives in. Okay? Do you know how many kosher restaurants there are in Yerushalayim? Thousands. And it's not just restaurants. Every hospital, every elementary school, every old age home, the army, right? All public government buildings are serving food that's supposed to be kosher. Okay? And not just Yerushalayim. You know, even in some random small city with not so many religious people, in this country, the Rabbanut has set up a system where they're trying to create a situation where as much as possible, the food in this country is kosher.
There still are non-kosher and places.
There are. But by the way, mainly restaurants, because restaurants might be open on Shabbat, and that's the primary reason. But walk into any supermarket, not just here in Yerushalayim where there's a lot of religious people. Okay, next time you go away for Shabbat to a random city someplace, you know, Beit Sha'an or Ashdod or wherever you are, right? Walk into a random supermarket, walk up and down the aisles, and see if you can find a single product that doesn't have any sort of kosher supervision at all. You probably won't be able to find. It's very rare. Sometimes wine, in a, like a really fancy place where they want to sell fancy wines. But in almost all cases, you can't find such a product. That's an incredible accomplishment. But in order to do that, the Rabbanut has to make certain decisions. Okay, first of all, they don't have the manpower. Okay, even in a place like Flatbush with 200 restaurants, I don't know how many, what the Vada Rabbanim of Flatbush and how many supervisors they have, but it's still a much smaller operation than it is in a city in Israel when they're supervising thousands of operations. And they don't necessarily have the manpower, and they can't charge the prices, right? Israelis who aren't necessarily all that religious are willing and interested in eating kosher food, but they're not necessarily willing to pay exorbitant prices to do so. And therefore, the Rabbanut doesn't necessarily have the budget, right? They're charging money for the supervision, but they don't necessarily have the budget to set up, you know, very large staffs of supervisors. And on top of that, if they start being very, very machmir with all kinds of questions, gelatin, for example, and also gelatin's a good example. The economics are changing, and more and more and more people are using fish gelatin, which doesn't have these halakhic problems. But it used to be that that the animal gelatin was, that the synthetic or fish gelatin was two or three times the price. And if a company would use that gelatin, they'd have to charge double or triple the price for the marshmallows. Okay, so there's a market for certain people, right? You know, people that are willing to pay double or triple the price because they care enough about halacha and about following that particular shita to do it. But it, on the whole country's level, you're not going to do that. So the Rabbanut has to rely on these leniencies in order to accomplish this greater good. But where does that leave somebody who in her own personal life, doesn't necessarily want to rely on those leniencies, either because I come from a different... Right, we have another thing we have here in Eretz Yisrael, Baruch Hashem, is kibbutz galuyot. We have Jews coming from all over the world who have different. We have Ashkenazim and we have Sephardim and we have people who came from different countries. Right, we came from America, most of us. In America, Rav Moshe Feinstein's Pesachim, Lechumra and Lekula were widely accepted. But people came from other countries didn't necessarily follow those Piskei Halacha. They have other rabbis and other shita. Now we're all living here together. And what your rabbi says, what my rabbi says, what am I supposed to do? So. From here has come the concept of kasher lemehadrin. And very often, so for example, the Rabbanut here in Yerushalayim, for example, on a restaurant, will offer two types of kashrut supervision. They'll offer what's called a basic supervision, and they'll offer kasher lemehadrin. Kasher lemehadrin, and if you go on their website, if you call them up and speak to them, they have publications, and they'll show you exactly what these terms mean, and exactly what the standards are, and what shitot they're following, and what leniencies they're relying on. So does that mean you should eat only mahadrin? It's not that simple either. Because, first of all, there's not one standard of mahadrin either. And even though the Rabbanut HaRashit tried to standardize this across the country, but there are also many private organizations, all the various badatzim that you'll see. And the badatzim disagree with each other also. One badatz is machmir on this, but mekel on that, and the other one is machmir on the other thing and mekel on the first thing. And then there also, unfortunately, are a lot of what we call now fake badatzim. Okay, Rabbi Lerner Sheet had that also. In the last 5 or 10 years here in Israel, there's a whole set of organizations that have discovered that they can make a lot of money by selling big, fancy, colorful te'udot that look very, very impressive and charging very little money for them because they don't really do very much. Mashkiach usually shows up about once a month to collect a check and that's about it. So there are legitimate badatzim like the Eda Haredit and like Rav Landau and Rav Kook and Rehovot. There's a whole list of those that he handed out, and there are also badatzim that are completely with all kinds of fancy names like Nachalat Yitzchak and Nezer Hahidur and all kinds of things with very impressive looking large colorful tudot with all kinds of Hebrew words all over the place, and they mean nothing because the person telling them in some cases they're literally nothing, and I've checked into this myself also, and I could tell you stories. And on top of that, you might say, okay, let's say I come from Chutzlatz, let's say I come from America, I want to do what the OU does. That's what I want to do. Just tell me which tudah to look for that has the OU standards, and I'll follow that. And now the OU's here. But even the OU doesn't have the same standards in Israel that they have in America. The OU of Israel has different standards than the OU in America. And if you go with the Rabbanut, for example, so Rabbi Lerner said, and it's basically true, that the regular Rabbanut Hashgacha is more lenient standards than the OU, and the Mahadrin or Badas Hashgachas are stricter standards than the OU. The OU standards itself doesn't really exist here. But even that's true, but there are exceptions to that. I gave you an example already of something, Chalav Yisrael, where the Rabbanut here is more machmir than the OU, and the OU is more makel. I'll give you another example of Chadash. The OU will give Ashkacha and Chadash, the Rabbanut here will not. On the other hand, there are cases where the Badatzim are more makel than the OU. Right? If you fly El Al, from New York, or if you get an airplane meal with an OU hashgacha, they won't give you what they call a mezonos roll. Right? They'll only give you a roll that's hamotzi, and they won't write on their mezonos because the OU's poskim hold that there's no such thing as a mezonos roll, and that it's a scam, and it's usher to eat such a roll without making hamotzi. Right? But the badatz eida charedit will put that on. So that's an example where the OU is more machmir than the eida charedit. So what are you supposed to do? There's no choice if you really want to do this properly, but to become educated and to learn. And you can also do some research. You can speak to the mashgiach yourself. On every Tudat Kashrut, there's a phone number. You can pick it up and call it, and somebody will actually answer. I've done it myself. You can talk to that person. In this country, you'll probably have to talk to that person in Hebrew. You can learn how to do that also. Okay? And Kashrut organizations all have offices, and they'll respond to phone calls, they'll respond to emails, and if you want to know what exactly is the situation with this particular product, you can find out. It takes work, and it takes knowledge. But that's basically the background of all this. Okay, we have 2 minutes for questions. I said five, but I got two left. So yes, Corinne.
So you're talking about OUs and all this, and Mishpacha. What about like a regular K with no circle at the end?
A regular K doesn't mean anything. See, the OU is a copyrighted symbol. If I go ahead and I print a package with an OU symbol on it and I don't have the authorization from the OU, they can sue me. And they do. And it's copyrighted by law. But a K is a letter in the English alphabet. Anybody can write K on something.
So a K circle is copyrighted though?
Okay. No, a K circle is a copyrighted symbol. That's okay. That's a different organization. Yes?
So are you basically saying that in Israel the ultimate way to keep kosher is by picking your own shita on every single food and then seeing if that's not stuck on it? That seems ridiculous.
That's not exactly what I said. The optimal way to observe kashrut is to become educated, to understand what the issues are. In this class, with the span of what we can do in 1 hour a week, we will cover many of the issues, and you can then begin to know what sort of things to look out for. You don't have to call the mashgiach every single time, although you might. Or you can also know that, for example, like I said to you before, right? If I only eat Chalav Yisrael and I see a product with an OUD, right? I can't eat that product unless I call up the OU and find out, right? But if I just was told don't eat OU, then I can't eat anything with the OU, even though there are many things I can eat if I know a little bit and I understand. And that's what I'm trying to tell you. If someone says to you, I don't eat this product, right? You have to know why. And let me close with this one story. Okay, this story really drills this into me. Okay, and I'll close with this story. When I made Aliyah 15 years ago, so I made Aliyah, and before I made Aliyah, I was a high school teacher, and there was a girl who I was very close with, a student of mine. She came to our house for Shabbat all the time. I had a very good relationship with her as a student, and she graduated high school 1 year before I made Aliyah. And she came to Israel. I actually wanted her to go to MMY. It was the first year of MMY. She didn't. She chose to go somewhere else. Doesn't matter where. Okay. So then, fine. The second year, a year later, I made Aliyah. And this girl was Shana Bet. So I said to her, we're going to invite you over to our house for Shabbat. We were new Olim. And I was a student. She was back in Israel, Shana Bet. I said, you'll come to me for Shabbat. And I kept inviting her. And she kept having reasons why she couldn't come. And finally, I got the sense that something was up here. I started pushing her, why aren't you coming to me for Shabbat? And she said, you know what, I think I can be honest with you. And I said, of course you can be honest with me. And I had the sense already that there was an issue here of kashrut. Now, if she told me that, listen, I'm machmir for certain shita that you don't follow and I don't want to offend you or anything like that, I bechlal wouldn't have been upset. Either I would have gone out and gotten food that she could eat, or I would tell her, listen, I guess you can't eat my house, and I really wouldn't have been upset. I lived in Muncie. You know, I always had Chalav Yisrael in the house, even though I don't personally makbe, because I had small children and I wanted their, you know, friends to be able to come over, and I'm totally fine with that. But that's not what the girl said to me. This is what bothered me. The girl told me, what was her issue? Her issue was vegetables, right? And in her seminary, they said to her, you can only eat badatz vegetables. And she doesn't trust the Rabbanut on vegetables. She said...
She doesn't have to eat vegetables in your house.
Well, it's kind of hard because, like, everything is cooked with whatever. Okay. And Corinne doesn't eat that many vegetables. But that was her issue. Okay. So, she said, where do you get your vegetables from? Are they badatz? I said, they're not badatz. I buy them in my local makolet.
It's hard to start your clothing.
Ooh, I'm over time? Thanks. Okay. I'll be finished in 1 second. Sorry. I buy them, just close the door, I'll be finished. I buy them in my local makolet, and the rabbi of that makolet, who supervises the makolet, I know personally, and I know the guy that he sends into the makolet every morning to personally take trumot and masorot from the vegetables. So no, it's not a badatz. But I'm telling you, if you trust me, I'm telling you, I personally know the mashgiach in this. It's not badatz edekhoidis. It's a little makolet alon shvut. In those days, now it's done differently. But in those days, there was a guy from the yeshiva who went in every morning and took the trumot and masorot. And she was told, you're only allowed to eat badatz. And she didn't come to my house. That bothered me, not because she didn't trust my standards. It bothered me because it was unsophisticated. Badatz doesn't mean anything. Okay? If she understands that there's an issue, and she's able to verify what the issue is, you know, in that particular case, there was no reason for her to do that. The goal is to become educated.